بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد، الله صلى وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين، واللعن الدائم على أعدائهم أجمعين. Okay, as I said last night, we're going to do Ahkam first, a little bit, till the people arrive, and then we'll get into the main topic, inshallah. Last night, I gave an example, and I was thinking maybe we should clarify this. Last night, I talked about lobster, right, a little bit. That was just an example, okay? It was just an example when I said that a marja might say that lobster is halal, okay, or obligatory precaution that it's halal. Okay, that was just an example. I wasn't saying it's halal or it's an obligatory precaution that it's haram. No, it's Maraja, Ayatollah Sistani, Ayatollah Khamenei, they all say that it's haram. It was just an example. Moving on to another ruling that we usually deal with a lot, and I get this question. I got this question actually today, and I usually try to cover it here and there. It's about Salat al-Jama'ah. You know, the congregational prayer. So when it comes to congregational prayer, we have to follow the imam, they say, right? We have to follow the imam. And what is meant by following the imam? Could you recite salat? Some of us are afraid to come up. Anyway. Following the imam. Okay, what does that exactly mean? Some people will follow the imam in everything, in every single part of the prayer. But let's break down the prayer and the different parts of prayer. Prayer has two types of parts, let's say. Let's call it. One is the actual movements, ruku', sajda, the sitting, standing, all of that. And then you have the dhikr, the recitation parts, the parts where you recite something. So sometimes you're reciting, sometimes you're moving, and you have movements. When it's said that in Salat al-Jama'ah, you have to follow the imam, does it mean that we have to follow the imam in everything, both in those movements and in the dhikr, for example? I am in sajda, and the imam's in sajda. I have to wait for the imam to say Subhana Rabbi al-A'la wa bihamdas, for me to be able to start saying Subhana Rabbi al-A'la wa bihamdas. So for example, if the imam is silent in his sajda for whatever reason, I have to keep silent until he starts his dhikr, and then I do a dhikr. Or even more than that, do I have to do the exact same dhikr he does or not? Or is it that we just have to follow in the movements of salah? The answer is pretty clear. Only in the movements. So you can't go to ruku' before the imam. You can't get up from ruku' or sajda before the imam. All of these things that are movements, we have to follow the imam. We can't fall ahead of the imam. But when it comes to the dhikr, if we go to sajda, the imam, for whatever reason, is silent. I can do my dhikr. I can do another dhikr. If he's saying Subhana Rabbi al-A'la wa bihamda, for example, in sajda, I can say three subhanallahs. I don't have to necessarily say the exact same thing he is. If my marja says the tasbihat al-arba'ah, those what we recite in the third and fourth rakat, if my marja says I can recite it once, but the imam is reciting it three times, I can do it once, he does it three times. By the way, Ayatollah Sistani, Ayatollah Khamenei say one time is enough. You don't have to say it three times. Although it's better, of course, to say it three times. So when it comes to Salat al-Jama'ah, that's what we have to do. Question now. What if I am following the imam, and in the movements, for whatever reason, I get up before the imam? And this is also something that happens, especially those of us who want the imam to finish quicker. Sometimes when you're stuck in traffic, you feel like if you press on the gas pedal, you'll move the cars out of the way and go quicker. That's not the case. Don't try this at home. Same thing here. Sometimes, for whatever reason, we'll get out of the ruku', get up from ruku', get up from sajda before the imam. What do? Because some people, they know their stuff. They know that if you add a ruku' to your salat, what happens? It becomes batil. if you are praying at home individually, whatever, not in jama'ah, and you do a ruku', you get back up from ruku', and accidentally you go to ruku' again and you do another ruku', what happens to your salat? Your salat is batil. Okay? Because ruku' is a rukn, is one of the pillars of salat. That's another story. I might talk about it tomorrow night. So adding a ruku' makes your salat void. Alright. So now I am praying behind an imam in jama'ah. The imam gets up from the ruku'. I get up from the ruku' because I thought the imam got up from ruku', but turns out he's still in ruku'. What do I do? So some people, they say, if you go back to ruku', you're breaking your salat because you added another ruku'. Is that the case or not? That's not the case. In jama'ah, it's different. In jama'ah, if you get up from ruku' before the imam, you have to go back down to ruku'. If you go to sajda before the imam, go back to sajda. Excuse me, if you get up from the sajda before the imam, go back to sajda. If I go to sajda before the imam, what do I do there? Well, get up, wait for him to go to sajda, and then you go to sajda. So following is this strict when it comes to the movements, but when it comes to the actual dhikr, it's not wajib. Even in tashahud, you can fall ahead of the imam. You can finish your tashahud, he's still in the beginning of his tashahud, but you can't get up for the third or fourth rakat until he gets up for his tashahud. Recite three salawats, please. Three means three. But two more. When it comes to being religious, being a proper mu'min, one that the imam and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala are happy with, there's different things that contribute, factor into this. One which is very important is our worldview, the way we look at things. If you don't have an Islamic worldview, if you don't have an Islamic ideology, and don't look at things from an Islamic perspective, you'll mess up. We don't believe in what the Western culture teaches us, what Western ideology, how it looks at things. We don't believe in that. But when it comes to the non-Muslims and the Western culture, they've done a good job. Because their base of understanding is different than ours. Okay, but the foundations of ideology that they have matches the building that they have built on this foundation. What do I mean? If somebody hallucinates and is delusional and sees, for example, I don't know, in these cartoons you'll see sometimes like it's a bird, but the cat is so hungry he sees it as a fried chicken or a roast chicken, right, ready to eat. He's hungry. He sees it like that. So he goes and bites into it. Turns out that the feathers come in his mouth. Did he do something wrong? We say, no, he didn't do something. What he did wasn't wrong. Because he was seeing this as roast chicken. So he went and bit into it. If you see something as that, although it might be wrong, but if you see it like that and you go and bite into it, what happened? Can we scold you for that? No. All right, unless you've done something to your sight yourself voluntarily that you see things differently, that's another story. But what you've done is justified. If someone sees something as a tiger or lion or something or some beast or whatever and runs away from it, can we scold them for that while it turns out it was just a kitten? No, he sees it like that. Well, of course, then the natural consequence, the natural whatever reaction is that this person flees. So fleeing is not the problem here. Fleeing is that building that was built on a foundation. What was the foundation? Seeing this little animal as a beast. Okay? I hope I can get this across. So sometimes the way we look at something is wrong. Sometimes we look at something, we see it, and then we react accordingly. The reaction is right. So Western culture, Western ideology is doing the right thing according to the way they look at this dunya and the way they look at everything. It's non-Islamic. If everything in this world, every pleasure you can think of is limited to this life, then they are doing the right thing. Please don't misunderstand what I'm trying to say here. Pay attention. Sure, we know that they're looking at it the wrong way. I mean, when you go on the internet, for example, all you see all over the place is that everything is fixated on the pleasures of this life. Why? We're upset about this, but not because this is the wrong reaction. We say, look, they're not looking at it the right way. They're seeing this life, they're seeing this world, they're seeing the purpose as this. Well, if you see the purpose as this, what are you going to do? You're going to go after it. So what they're doing is right, actually, in this sense. But the foundation is wrong. The building is right. The foundations are problematic. So if you want to make sure your building is going to stand there forever, you have to make sure the foundations are proper foundations. And that's where Islamic ideology comes in. If you don't have proper Islamic ideology, no matter how much you try, you can't build the building on the foundations because the foundations are shaky. Okay, if I see something as food when it's not food, no matter how much of that I have, I won't become full. I'll starve to death. So I have to fix that first. And then if I fix that, even a little bit of that food is actually food for me. But if I don't fix it, no matter how much in quantity I have of that thing, it won't do any good. So when it comes to being religious, one of the first steps we have to put behind us is proper Islamic ideology. For example, I'm going to give some examples that will help us understand what happens when we have proper Islamic ideology, proper Islamic worldview and perspective towards things. They'll come up to you, they'll say, your religion, what is wrong with your religion? Why? You say women can't lead prayers. That's so sexist, that's so prejudiced, what is this religion? How are they looking at it? They're looking at the whole thing differently than us. Yes, with their worldview, I would have this same question. Everything is limited to this life. If one person is allowed to stand in front, others should also have that honor of standing out in front. Okay? What else you got? Oh my God, you're trying to tell me that your women will never have that experience of the wind blowing through their hair because they have to wear that veil. Yes, according to your worldview, this is totally unjust. Totally unjust. Because everything is limited to here. They will never get the chance. Well, sometimes the guys don't get the chance either. For example, swimming is hard in these non-Muslim countries because there's haram happens. So you can't, you won't get that experience that much. And you'll miss out on this. You're missing out. Missing out, what does missing out mean? That means I'll never get it? Well, yes, if this whole life is what counts, that's true. But is that my ideology? It gives me patience. It gives me understanding that there's more to it. No girlfriend. No boyfriend. They're always throwing this at us, all these kinds of things at us. And it's true. I understand, if I didn't have this Islamic worldview myself, I would be into all these things, just like all of us would be into all these things. Say that there was no Akhirah, would we be here right now? Of course not. It wouldn't make sense for us to be here unless we had lost our minds. Because that's all that counts, all that matters, and the only place to get it is here. Well, then let's go for it. They're constantly using this thing. Slaughtering animals, that's so cruel. Yes, that is so cruel. It may seem, but with that, once again, world view, that ideology, it's different. That's why I get upset sometimes. Some people, they'll say, I'm vegetarian. Muslim. A Muslim will say, I'm vegetarian. Okay, you're vegetarian, that's good. It's okay. Nothing wrong with that. But then the reasoning they use shows that the ideology is flawed. What's the reasoning for it? Well, it's cruel. Wait a minute. This is what Western culture teaches us. If it was cruel, and it is cruel, then that means Allah is telling us that something that is cruel, something that is zulm and dhulm and oppression is Allah. Is that the case?
No.
It shows that the ideology is flawed here. Yes, I don't eat meat that much because it's not encouraged. I don't eat meat that much because I feel that it will be harmful to my body. I don't eat it because it's whatever the reason is, good. It's good. That's good. But if you're going to say, I'm a vegetarian because killing animals is cruel. I understand. It doesn't look good. Of course not. But has Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala allowed it or not? Yes, He has. And that means this is not dhulm then. This shows that the ultimate sahib, the ultimate owner of everything, has allowed it. So it shows that there is a greater benefit in it. It shows that the ideology is a little, there's a bit of an inaccuracy and deficiency here. Fasting, same thing. Seriously, if Islam hadn't told us and we didn't have that ideology, would we fast? Of course not. Things like that. And the list goes on and on and on. Lots of times people will come to me and they'll say, how do I explain, for example, to my atheist friend that fasting is good? Or I have to fast? Or how do I explain the hijab to them? I say, listen, we are... The problem we have with this is that it's the foundation here. The foundations aren't matching. Sometimes I will see oranges, another person will see oranges, we fight over how many they are. Sometimes I'll see five oranges, he'll see five apples. Apples and oranges can't be compared like that. He can't fight me and say, there's five apples here, and I say, no, it's five oranges here. Right? There's five whatever. Because apples and oranges aren't compared. If you have to share the same ideology, then you can debate a little bit. So sometimes you just can't debate with others unless you want to change their foundations of thought. These were all examples to get this importance across. Now, Islamic ideology, Islamic thought, Islamic worldview has different aspects. Okay, we have different perspectives here. Islam has perspectives regarding, for example, theology. Theology meaning the study of the theos, God. Eschatology, the akhirah, what happens after death, all of that stuff. We're going to be zooming, inshallah, over these nights on one of these aspects that Islam has a perspective on, which I really like, and I've always wanted to do this. Alhamdulillah, Allah has given the tawfiq, inshallah, we'll do this over some nights. And the reason it takes several nights, brothers and sisters, is that I don't look at the minbar as something that, yes, it's like a classroom or... Someone sits up there, has a course on something, a lecture on something, finished, tomorrow let's do something else that's totally irrelevant. No. The mimbar, from the mimbar, nur has to come. Okay? And things have to be explained in a way that slowly people digest it. And that's why you'll see usually ulama, they'll extend it a little bit so that stuff comes out of it. Okay? We don't want to like just teach here. We want to get some nur, inshallah, from the Ahlul Bayt, inshallah. So, before revealing this aspect that Islam has a perspective on, I'm going to do it through a story that I thought of. Once upon a time, recite salawat first. Once upon a time, there was this very, very, now excuse me for this example, there was this beautiful mistress who had... I gave this example today too, had dipped into the fountain of youth and fountain of life. She was eternal. What would she do? She would go and find people, guys, and offer herself to them and say, would you like to have my hand in marriage? And of course they wouldn't pass up on it, but she had one condition. She would say, when you get married to me, there's one condition, and that is, whenever I want, I can have you die. I can have you, me and you, separated whenever I wish. It might happen tomorrow, I don't know. It might happen 2 years from now, I don't know. 10 years from now. Maybe even 80 years from now. But there's always a chance that it's going to be tomorrow. There's always a chance it's going to be 10 days from now. I can poison you whenever I like. There was many who fell for this because the beauty they didn't look at the long run, they looked at the short-lived pleasure. this woman would deceive many. She wouldn't deceive them. She would tell them that this is what my conditions are. You can accept if you like. You can reject if you like. Okay, so let's not put the blame on her. It's the guy that wanted it. So okay, some she would get married to 10 days after, some years after. She's eternal, she doesn't care. And so on and so forth. But then one day she comes to someone, and he turns around and says, really? You have this condition? If you had not put this condition, I would have accepted. But since you have put this condition, no, I'm not going to accept. I'm not going to give up my eternity through marrying you and then losing it all of a sudden. I'm not going to give it up and jeopardizing it. No. And he sent her away and she was shocked. What happened? What did this story have to do with anything? Let me read for you from Nahjul Balagha and from the hadith that we have. There's a famous hadith that goes like this. Now, this is famous hadith, I'll explain it. They say, Imam Ali alayhi salam, I won't read the Arabic, it's too long. Say salawat. They say Imam Ali alayhi salam was in the land of Fadak once and holding a shovel. Yes, the Imams would shovel. The Imams would work hard. The Imams would break sweat. I talked about this last year. I'm not going to get back into it. It says, فَهَجَمَتْ عَلَيْهِمْ رَأَىٰ. A woman all of a sudden approached him. Imam Ali alayhi salam. مِنْ أَجْمَلِ النِّسَىٰ. Of the most beautiful of women came to him. So that's where I got my story from. She says, oh son of Abu Talib, if you marry me, I will make you needless of this shovel. You won't need this shovel anymore. You won't have to work anymore. And I will guide you to the treasures of this world. And you will stay, وَيَكُون لَكَ الْمُلْكِ. And you will have power for as long as you live. As long as you live. Imam Ali says, who are you? What does she say? I am the dunya. I am the dunya. Now what this exactly was, it was an apparition, a disclosure. What it was, we don't know exactly. But this is a very famous hadith. She says, I'm the dunya. He said, irji'i, get out of my face, go away, return. Utfatlubi zawjan ghayri, go find another partner. Don't come to me. You have nothing to do with me. And he turns back to his shovel and starts shoveling again. What does that mean? She said to him one thing that was dangerous. She said to him, you will have all of this as long as you live. That means what? It's short-lived. It's not long-lived. It's going to end sometime. For that time that you have me, you're going to have it all. But when it ends, it's going to end. So there is an end. Imam Ali says, I don't want it. Now three hadiths here I thought about that I thought I'll share with you. Very nice. We have a very famous dua from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam that he says in that dua. He says, Allahumma rizqna tajafiya an dar al-ghurur. Oh Allah, give me tajafi. Tajafi means a person who is not standing completely but not sitting either. He wants to get up, kind of detached, but still there. Imam Sajjad says, oh Allah, give me tajafi, which means a sort of detachment from this world, oh Allah. But he calls this world Dar al-Ghurur, the place where deceit takes place. Deceit. Now, what does he put on the other side as the opposite, the antonym of world of deceit? He says, oh Allah, take me away from this and then give me what? Dar al-Khulud. Eternity, the abode of eternity. So these are opposite to each other. Eternity and deceit. If it's not eternal, brothers and sisters, right, we're being fooled. Over there the lady says, as long as you live, and he hears that. He says, wait a minute, so that means it's gonna end. Yes, it's gonna end sometime. He says, I don't want it. Now of course I don't want to sound cliche. those of you who know me, I hate cliche stuff. Stuff that's been said again and again and again without explanation, taken out of context, all of that. No, we don't like it. Oh, the dunya is bad, get away from the dunya. No, no. We'll talk about it. They come to Imam Ali, a person who was very spiritual, and he came to Imam Ali, he starts talking bad about the dunya. All of a sudden, Imam Ali, the way he talks about the dunya, as if the dunya is the akhirah. And he says, you are scolding the dunya, this good place, this awesome place. And he explains though. There's an explanation, inshallah, future nights we'll get to it. No, we don't want to be a cliche. We want to see what Islamic perspective is exactly when it comes. What is the essence of dunya? What is the essence? The thought of dunya. How is it? What do we have to be careful for? It's beautiful. Some of the things, and by the way, the things I'll be talking about are coming from ulama. As you probably, some of you already know, I try to relate from the ulama a lot. Lots of points from Ayatollah Jawadi Amali, may Allah protect him. About this essence of dunya, how it is. Okay, we want to get this dunyaology down properly. We want to have, the same way we have theology, study of God, eschatology, which is study of the akhirah and stuff like that. We want to have dunyaology. I made this word up myself, I like that. Dunyaology, right? Dunyaology, or in short, dunyaology, which means study of this dunya, of the essence of dunya. How is it? Like, how are we supposed to look at it? Anyway, he says, oh Allah, give me this instead of that. Khulud, eternity. On the other side, not non-eternity or whatever. He says, deceit. So if it's not eternal, you're being deceived. And we're going to need this in future nights. What else do we have? We have a hadith, very famous hadith. Mutu, the Prophet of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he says, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. Mutu qabla an tamutu. Die before you die. What does that mean? That means, once again, detach from this life before you're detached from it through death. So that first mutu, that first die, is metaphorical. Meaning death is detachment, right? Die means detach. Before you're detached through actual death. If you detach before that, and once again, we're not talking cliche here, we'll talk about what detaching means, inshallah. If you detach the way you're supposed to detach, you've secured that side. You have the eternity side. But if you don't detach, what happens is you compromise the eternity for something that's not eternal. You're deceived, according to Tajafi, that Imam Sajjad said. What else do we have? Imam Ali says, "An-nas niyamun, fa'idha ma tuntabahu." People are dead. People are asleep, excuse me. People are asleep, and when they die, they wake up, subhanAllah. Look at this, like, you know, he's like, it's as if he's playing with words. That's why they call the Nahjul Balagha, is called Nahjul Balagha, peak of eloquence, for a reason. You know, sometimes you can tell that the Qur'an is a miracle through Nahjul Balagha. How? Because Nahjul Balagha is so hard to understand. I mean, like, you've done like years and years of Arabic in the Hawza, for example. It's so hard to understand Nahjul Balagha, but the Qur'an, which is a miracle, which is a book of Allah, coming from Allah, Allah is higher than Imam Ali, is so easy to understand compared to Nahjul Balagha. That itself is a miracle, that someone so high, the book that comes from him is so easily understandable. But Nahjul Balagha, which is coming from someone lower than Allah, but is of course attached to Allah and is a reflection of Allah, it's so hard to understand. Nahjul Balagha is so hard to understand. But anyway, look at how he uses these words. He says they're asleep. When they die, they wake up. Hello, when you die, you're dead. There's no waking up. What are you talking about? Yes, from Imam Ali's perspective, death is also life. When they die, they wake up. That means now they see that, oh, it wasn't worth it. I switched my eternity for something that's not eternal. That mistress fooled me. She didn't fool me, I fooled myself. And this is the point we'll get to. The dunya isn't bad. The dunya isn't bad. For bad people it's bad, for good people it's good. Let's rephrase it. For people who have a bad perspective, who have a bad worldview, it's bad. For those who have the accurate Islamic slash Quranic slash Imam Ali Nahjul Balagha ik worldview, it's good. Inshallah, we're going to cover this a little bit more. Ya Imam Ali, take our hand through Nahjul Balagha and teach us what the essence is. What is it on the inside? We don't want to see the outside, we want to see the inside. Is it really as bad as some say? Is it as good as some say? We don't know. We have to see, inshallah. Recite salawat. Lots of stuff here I want to say, but I'll just skip. Yeah, just as an example again about this dunya and stuff and how unfair it is. I'm just preparing us for tomorrow night, inshallah. When you fly around a lot, like, in other words, when you're a sheikh and you fly around a lot, you start, you know, you get this insight that's given to you through lots of flights, that all of a sudden you're like flying over the North Pole. You're flying over different countries. You're looking down, you're seeing towns, villages, sometimes polar bears. And sometimes you ask yourself, you're like, these people that are here, don't they ever want to see that side of the world? I personally want to see the entire world. I want to know what's going on everywhere. What's going on? I'm deprived. I want to be able to, like, you know, get to know what's going on. But you can't do that. You're always in your own place. You see people at the airport. All she does is announces the flights. This person, don't they ever wish they had another job? Has it ever happened that, like, you ask yourself, like, what if, like, you don't like the face Allah gave you? Oh Allah, I wanted straight hair, you gave me curly hair. Oh Allah, the guy, he's like, I've met people, he's a guard that, like, stays up at night all the way till morning, and then throughout the day he's asleep. All he does is the most boring job you could have. This person is born into this family, that person is born into that family, all of these different things. It's just not fair. Okay? And these are things that push you to, like, you know, somehow you got to find a justification for all this. They say, oh Allah, you say you're all just, you're all kind. Some people are born not very privileged. What do? They work hard. They work hard, make a living, they achieve that American dream. But when the time comes to take pleasure in that, what they've achieved, all of a sudden, you see that the age has gone up. I was just talking about it right now with some. You are able to buy certain things you weren't able to buy before, but now you won't buy them anyway, because if you eat that stuff, then you're gonna get all fat because your metabolism has dropped. Why? Because you've aged. So you reach that, some don't even reach that ultimate goal of, you know, that wealth. Some work hard. All these greats right now that are running the show, they've done all that hard work. But when they reach it, it's too late. Well, it's for my kids now. And when my kids take pleasure in it, it's as if I'm taking pleasure. Yeah, whatever. It's not the same, you know it. Right? Some people, they'll justify it like that. My children are, Imam Ali in the Nahjul Balagha, he explains this. He says that this person spends his life doing this, to achieve this, through halal, haram, whatever. For him, it's a hard meal, it's a hard morsel that he gets. For others, it's an easy morsel. He dies, and it's inherited to others, inherit what his wealth was. It's not fair. It's just not fair. For those even who are privileged, also, we can't say much about them either. Can't say too much good stuff about them. Why? Because how much pleasure can you take? Don't you hate it when you go somewhere and they got the good food there, they got all the good stuff there, you pig out, but then all of a sudden you're full. You know this ain't going to happen again for a long time. Okay, these tables that they've set, it ain't going to happen in the near future. But you don't have enough room. Some people say, I wish I could change my stomach with another stomach so that I can take the pleasure again. Well, this isn't fair. I mean, this person is so well off, but he can't, no matter how much pleasure he takes, still there's more to take pleasure from, but he doesn't have the capacity, the darfiyat they call it. They don't have that. Is it fair? It's not fair. If that person even did have the capacity, death is going to come eventually, right? That's why our ulama say every now and then, go and visit the graveyard for a few minutes, not too much, Every now and then, if you feel like, okay, you feel like I'm looking at this dunya as if, all right, I'm going to be here forever, just take a little short walk and just get out. You don't have to stay there very long. Just get out. Well, make sure you do that once a year. Why? Because eventually death comes, right? These people, they're the wealthiest, but sometimes I even feel sorry for them. All these CEOs and stuff that are running the show right now, they die. Some of them have short lives, actually. The guy that passed away like 2 years ago, you guys know, right? It's not fair. So what? How do we explain this? It's not fair. Really, it's not fair. How do we explain it? All of these things are solvable only and only if Imam Ali takes our hand. Only and only if we do a little bit of research, a little bit of study, then if we look at things differently, it becomes so much easier for us to digest. I'm going to read an article for you, actually, some parts of an article about these people who are so wealthy and they've got everything. And how I mean, what I mean when I say it's just not fair. I mean, at least Allah, O dunya, let the people who have it at least, you know, take some pleasure in it. Some good pleasure in it. But you see that that's not the case either. This is an article I ran into like a week ago before I came. And I thought it was good to read some parts of it. So bear with me, I'm going to read real quick. So it's like 4 or 5 paragraphs I want to read. It starts like this. It starts, let me get my mouth ready. It says that they are crass. I don't even know what that means, but that they are crass, brash, and trashy goes without saying. This person is talking about some certain individuals. But there is something in the pictures posted on a certain group, on one of these social media websites. There's a group that rich kids come on and they flash their stuff in there. Show it all off. In parentheses here, when I was a kid, there was this one kid in our school who was very rich. Everyone knew it. Sometimes he would fill up his lunch bag with just like all the snacks. Like for us, like having like a pack of fruit snacks was like the like Jannah for us. The fruit roll-ups or like the Snickers or whatever, like that was it for us. But this kid, once I still remember this, he came with his lunch bag. And he started pulling out everything you see on the store shelves, like one of them, and a sample of it was in there. Pulled it out. And what did he say? He said, I'm showing you this to just let you know how rich I am. Okay? Same thing here. He goes, but there is something in the pictures that these people post on that social media group where the rich guys come that inspires more than the usual revulsion towards crude displays of whatever. There is a shadow in these photos. Photos of a young man wearing all 4 of his Rolex watches. A youth posing in front of his helicopter. Endless pictures of cars, yachts, shoes, mansions, swimming pools. Spoiled white boys throwing gangster poses in private jets. Or something of something worse. Okay, so that person says there's a shadow of something worse in these photos. You see all the glitter, but there's something worse here. Something that after you have seen a few dozen becomes disorienting, even distressing. He goes on, he says the pictures are of course intended to incite envy. They reek instead of desperation. It's beautiful. Now this is not Nahjul Balagha. Okay, this world has an essence that those people who just use their common sense a little bit can tell what's going on. But Imam Ali does it more beautifully and more accurately. Anyway, the young men and women seem lost in their designer clothes, dwarfed and dehumanized by their possessions, as if ownership has gone into reverse, subhanAllah. Don't let the thing own you. You should own the thing. This person is pointing to that. Anyway, goes on and on. And then this part's important. Perhaps I am projecting my prejudices, but an impressive body of psychological research appears to support these feelings. It suggests that materialism, a trait that can afflict both rich and poor, subhanAllah. Imam Khomeini used to say that materialism doesn't necessarily mean that you have all this wealth. Sometimes a person might be too attached to even his abba or like his tasbih. Materialism isn't just for the rich, it's for the poor too. Which the researchers define as a value system that is preoccupied with possessions and the social image they project is both socially destructive and self-destructive. It smashes the happiness and peace of mind of those who succumb to it. It's associated with anxiety, depression, broken relationships, all the way to the end. He talks. I don't want to bore you. Materialism forces us into comparison with the possessions of others, a race both cruelly illustrated and crudely propelled by that toxic website. There's no end to it as you go on. Allah has created us like this. Allah has created us that we want infinity. We want endlessness. We want to be eternal. But we just make a mistake in identifying what that is. He put us here to give us a taste of good life so that we want more. But the more doesn't come here. We can't just limit it. No tunnel vision here. This is the dreadful mistake we are making, allowing ourselves to believe that more money and more stuff enhances our well-being. And he goes on and on. This is all because of worldview. Sometimes worldview is inaccurate, sometimes it's accurate. Do you think Umar ibn Sa'd had a bad worldview? Do you think other oppressors during the Imam's times, they had the wrong worldview? Sometimes it's not because of you not having the wrong worldview. People during the Prophet's time, people who betrayed the Prophet after his demise. Do you think that it's because they didn't have the proper worldview? Sometimes you have the proper worldview, but it's weak. And it has to be strengthened through action. We'll talk about these inshallah, both aspects, in future nights. Assalamu alaikum ya Aba Abdullah. Yesterday, I made a point that sometimes the obstacle in the way of your dunya, you get rid of it. Sometimes you do more. Not only do you degrade that obstacle, remove it, but you degrade it. They ran over the body of Abu Abdullah. But I forgot to mention last night, not only did they run over the body of Abu Abdullah, they stoned the body of Abu Abdullah. Do you know who they stoned? The worst of the worst are stoned. In Islamic law, the worst of the worst are the ones who are stoned. Of course, it's not carried out often because it's hard to prove it. But if it is proven, it's carried out. I don't know what they had seen in Abu Abdullah Hussein, that they stoned the body of Abu Abdullah. Lady Zainab has to watch. But let's have a flashback to the beginning of the Ashura, before Ashura even happened. Two incidents I want to compare. Two incidents. Number one, they say when Abu Abdullah was moving towards Kufa, they heard a stampede. They looked around, they see that an army is coming towards the caravan of Abu Abdullah. Who is it? It's Hur ibn Yazid al-Riyahi. Do you think Lady Zainab was worried that, or the children were worried that something's going to happen? No. We have Imam Hussein, we have Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas, we have Ali al-Akbar. We have the rest of the Ashab. All of them are ready to give their lives. Zainab al-Kubra, I don't think she was very worried. Hur comes and says, you can't go to Kufa. And the story you know. So that's one incident. When the sound of the stampede and the horses and the people coming towards them didn't frighten them. They came to them. They said, you have to go and cast your tents right here for now. You cannot go to Kufa. What did they do? They came, the tents were set up. Lady Zainab wants to come down from her camel. Lady Zainab wants to come down. Everyone turns away. It doesn't look... The non-mahrams... Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas comes, they say Ali al-Akbar comes, they come to her, they say, oh Zainab, can you put your foot on my knee and come down? Can I have the honor of you putting your feet on my knees and coming down? Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas has ghairah. Ali al-Akbar has ghairah. But now let's go to Ashura and after Ashura. After they did what they did, after they've trampled the body of Abu Abdullah, all of a sudden the women and children hear another stampede. The women and children hear horses, they hear people running towards them, but this time there is no Hussein, there is no Abbas, there is no Akbar. Abbas, it kills him to see that someone oppresses a woman or a child. That's why his head is on the spears and he's still watching down on his Zainab as the army comes. This army is ready, this army is thirsty. It wants to get Hussein back. Hussein has killed our loved ones, our dear ones. Who is left of Hussein that's associated with Hussein? His children are left. But we're not talking about Ali al-Akbar being the children of Abu Abdullah. Ya sahib az-zaman. We're talking about 4-year-olds, we're talking about 2-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 10-year-olds. They're all running around. Lady Zainab comes to Imam Sajjad. Oh Sajjad, what do we do? You're the Imam of our time. Imam Sajjad says, Alaykunna bil firar. Just run around and disperse in different directions so we can minimize the damage. These children run left and right. Thorns are going into their feet. Earrings are being ripped off as the booty of the boar. They come to the tent of Sajjad alayhi salam. They're burning the tents. They want to kill Sajjad. All men have to be killed. Lady Zainab throws herself on Sajjad. This is the Imam of my time. I can't let him die too. You killed my brother. I won't let you kill the son of my brother. One child, they say, one little girl is running. Her clothing is on fire. One of these men comes to turn the fire off. She thinks that he wants to hurt him. He says, no, stop, I want to turn the fire off on your clothing. He turns the fire off. What's the next thing that this girl says? It's as if she told herself, Abbas didn't come back with water. She tells this man, can you give me a sip of water from somewhere? Abbas didn't come back. Little does she know that Abbas was cut to pieces. Night falls. These children have dispersed. Lady Zainab and the others have to go and find these children. After she has gathered everybody, she does a head count. She looks around. She sees that 2 are missing still. 2 of these children are missing. Where are they? Go back out to the desert. Go find them. Eventually they find 2 kids under a thorn bush. Under a bush they were hiding. They were so frightened that they had died in their arms in each other's arms. These are the Ahlul Bayt of Rasulullah. The next day, they say Sakina sees the body of her father. She falls on the body of her father. She says, I heard something from my father. Shi'ati mahma sharibtum. Ma'ad bin fadkuruni. Aw sami'tum bighareebin aw shaheedin fandubuni. Bibi Sakina says, I heard my father say, if you ever drink a sip of water, then remember me. If you ever remember a shaheed or a stranger, remember me. My body was left on the grounds of Karbala Atshana. They cut my body to pieces, but the worst of all comes in the next line. لَيْتَكُمْ فِي يَوْمِ عَاشُورَ جَمِيعًا تَنْظُرُونِي كَيْفَ أَسْتَسْقِي لِطِفْلِي فَأَبَاهُ أَنْ يَرْحَمُونِي. I wish you were there, O Shia of Hussein, when I walked on to the battlefield with my asghar. I pleaded to the enemy, if I have done nothing wrong, if my son has done nothing wrong, then why do you deprive him of water? Oh my Shia, I wish you were there to see how I begged the enemy for water. But they denied my asghar water. All of a sudden, when Abu Abdullah is holding Asghar in the sky, a 3-pronged arrow arrives. They say, Abu Abdullah was addressing the enemy. He felt the baby was shaking in his hand. He looks at Asghar and sees the head is hanging from the skin. Oh my Asghar, they killed you. Oh my Asghar, I am the one to bury you. أَلَا لَعْنَةُ اللَّهِ عَلَى الْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلَبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ نسألك اللهم وندعوك باسمك العظيم العظام العز الأجل الأكرم بفاطمة وأبيها وبعلها وبنيها والسر المستودع فيها يا الله 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 يا رحمن يا رحيم يا مقلب القلوب ثبت قلوبنا على دينك اللهم عجل لوليك الفرج واجعلنا من خير أعوانه وأنصاره والمستشهدين بين يديه اللهم اشف مرضانا اللهم اشف مرضانا وارحم موتانا وسلم ديننا ودنيانا وسلم مسافرينا اللهم احفظ إمامنا اللهم احفظ علماءنا اللهم احفظ وأيد قائدنا وعجل اللهم في فرج مولانا صاحب الزمان صلوات